Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime. If you're joining me for the first time, welcome. I do craft and story time where I tell you something horrible and I crochet and we craft together. You know, kind of that craft kind of vibe or craft circle kind of vibe, but virtual. If you're joining me on Spotify or Apple Music, welcome as well. I'm still working on the book sleeve, which I haven't had a physical book in a while, so it looks like it'll fit, but I'm going to have to, like, test it out. Anjali, sorry. Yeah, so I don't know if you can see it. I can't see it. I'm on a weight loss journey. I had my last baby a year ago, just over, almost a year and a half ago, and I have not been able to lose. I lost some weight, then I gained it back because of stress. So I'm hoping as I do these, y'all see the change, because I don't, and it's very depressing. But my man's on the journey with me now, so I'm super excited because I'm hoping we'll encourage each other and get there faster. So I'm excited. I hope y'all see a change, because I don't. It's terrible. Anyway, this isn't about me. What it's about, and get ready for this one, because I don't think anybody could have prepared for how quickly this escalated and where it went. But let's get into it. If you hear my baby crying, I swear I'm not neglecting her. Her father's downstairs with her. She's kind of a rage baby. She's like, everything makes her mad. She's tired. So if by chance that makes it in here, I assure you, someone is there with her. She's just mad. All right. So we are in Dodge City, which, you know, I'm not sure. I wish I would have looked this up, but I wonder if that's where, like, the whole term, like, get out of Dodge. I'm assuming it did. We're going to say it did. But we are in Dodge City. Horrible crime rate at this time that we're starting off. Crime's really bad. Low income, socioeconomics aren't great. So not the ideal place to raise a family. And that's where we get to Reginald Carr. Reginald Carr was born November 14th, 1977. And then his little brother, Jonathan, was born March 30th in 1980. Now, these boys did not grow up with loving parents. Their parents were abusive. They were also alcoholics. So there was no nurturing for these boys. They were kind of left to fend for themselves. So they grew quite the dependency on each other. I would say Jonathan was more dependent on Reginald because, you know, Reginald looked out for him and Jonathan seemed like more of the sensitive child, like really needing someone and needing direction. Well, both boys needed direction and that's what they didn't have. There was no empathy in this house. There was no guidance. There was no love. It was a horrible environment for these boys. Actually, it was so sad and so bad. Not so sad. I'm sorry. It is sad. But this was so hard and traumatic for these kids at such a young age. Jonathan tried to commit suicide at 7 years old. Seven. That is so heartbreaking. And I know people are going to be like, oh, you're empathizing with them. I'm empathizing with a child who had no chance, or whose chances were stripped of him before he had a choice. So let's just clear that up now, because I know how y'all can be. Like, no, I am not empathizing for horrible people, but I will always empathize for children. All right. Oh my God, I just realized I have stains on my shirt. Oh, it's the kids. I can't even have nice stuff anymore. They're little, so, you know, everything's always on their fingers. Anyway, so, yes, Jonathan tries to commit suicide at the age of 7. Super heartbreaking. And, you know, that's their whole life growing up. Hardship, abuse, really just dependency on your brother to get you through the hard days. Because it doesn't sound like there were very many good days in that house. Now, by the time Reginald is 18, he's been in and out of the system. He's constantly in trouble for things, you know, from like thieving to violent crime eventually. And, you know, every time he gets out, Jonathan's just there waiting for him. And, like, just two peas in a pod with a compulsion. Like, as soon as he comes home, they jump right back into crime. Immediately. Every time. They just turn that corner. Every time. Which, you know, it's a very curious case for the whole nature versus nurture argument. That's for sure. Because clearly it's both. You know, the whole nurture, there was no nurture. So, it was, you know, it wasn't going to produce. Well, it was going to be, I guess, more difficult to produce, you know, law-abiding citizens. Or at least two of them, you know. So these poor kids, you know, they, maybe it didn't have to go this way. But, anyway, so, they turn to crime. And then by the time that they're 22 and 20, and this is in the year 2000, Reginald, who's clearly the ringleader, Jonathan does everything Reginald says. And that's the kind of bond they have. It's almost as if like Reginald was Jonathan's father figure. And I think they both fed off of each other. Jonathan got that from Reginald. I think Reginald got kind of like an ego stroke or like a little dopamine hit that his brother looked up to him so much and he had this control over him. And no matter what he wanted to do, Jonathan's going to be in with him. Jonathan's going to say yes. He's not going to turn his back on me. So, you know, as great as that is, when you have bad intentions, not the kind of bond you want two people to share when it's that. So, how am I doing this? Okay, so, December 8th, Reginald decides that him and Jonathan are going to go to Wichita, Kansas, and target people in nice cars and rob them. So that's what they did. So December 8th, they get this idea. And then they go on the hunt, basically, for victims. And this is where they run into Andrew Schreiber. Andrew Schreiber was just leaving a convenience store when he is suddenly held at gunpoint. He's put into his car. And he's actually driven around by the brothers, hitting different ATMs and taking out as much as possible. So Andrew Schreiber he's driven around. They take as much out as possible. And once they're done, once basically they hit his ATM limit, they assault him, shoot his tires out, and then that's it. They're just gone, you know? Done. They're done with him. And, you know, Andrew calls the police, makes a report, but really all the police have to go off of at this point is that it was two blackmails. That's it. He didn't get anything else. So, cut to about, let's see, that was December 8th. 3 days later, December 11th. December 11th, Ann Walenta is driving home. And this lady she sounds like such a sweetheart. You know, she's an older woman. She's actually a cellist for the symphony in the area. She's also a librarian. And she's driving home and the car behind her is making her a little anxious. You know, something's off with it. So You know, she continues her drive. She just, you know, stays mindful of it, keeps an eye on them, pulls into her driveway. And when she pulls into her driveway, that car actually just passes her, but they turn around at the cul-de-sac, come back, park, and then the driver comes out. The driver comes out and approaches her, and Anne, you know, out of her weariness, she doesn't get out of the car. She cracks her window. But as she cracks her window, she sees the driver pull a gun to her window. As soon as she sees this, she throws that car in reverse and tries to get the hell out of there. But unfortunately, the gunman just starts firing. And unfortunately, they start firing. And unfortunately, she is struck. So her car just rolls down out of her driveway. It comes to a stop. She folds over and her head hits the horn. And the honking actually alerts the neighbors. So they're able to get her help. And her statement is just like Andrew's. She can only go off of two black males. She didn't get a good look at them either, especially because he started firing so damn quickly. She didn't get a look at him. So the police officers, all they really know at this point is that the two were most likely related. But they still don't know exactly who they're looking for. They don't know who these men are. And then that brings us to December 14th. It's been another 3 days after this. And a woman who is only identified as HG. I did find that her name is Holly. But if in like the documentary I watched and everything, is she still going by HG? I'm not going to give you out her name. So her name is HG. That's how she went through the investigation and everything. So HG and her boyfriend, Jason Beffert, are at home and they're heading, you know, they're going to bed for the night. They're turning in when they suddenly hear a knock at their door. And so they don't live alone in this house. They have roommates. But because of how late it is already, they're more on alert. They're a little cautious. They don't just ignore it. They don't go to the door, but they listen. And I mean, almost really soon after the doorbell goes off, their door is bursted into, their bedroom door, bursted open. There's two men with guns. All of their roommates are corralled into their bedroom. And these roommates are, so we have HG and Jason, who are a couple. Actually, Jason was planning on proposing to HG on Christmas. They'd been together for a few years. Very happy couple. They seem like very sweet. Actually, all of these people seem really sweet. There was also Aaron Sander, Brad Heike, and Heather Muller. And they are all corralled into HG and Jason's bedroom. So, they continue what they did with Andrew. One brother holds them at gunpoint. Actually, even before this, once they corral them, they ransack that room. But they ransack the room and uncover an engagement ring. And, you know, they're asking, like, well, whose is this and everything? Jason claims it. And that's how HG found out, which is awful. Fucking assholes ruined it. So that's when, again, yeah. They go and continue that whole ATM scheme. One brother stays in the room with some of the hostages. The other brother takes them in a car, drives them around until the ATM doesn't work anymore on that card, and brings them back. So once this is completed, I mean, what seems like a nightmare turns into a real fucking nightmare. Because the brothers start just assaulting everybody, sexually assaulting. Like, it's disgusting what these people went through. It's fucking awful. So they endure a heinous night when they're just in their homes, minding their own business, you know, and where you think you're safest, really. You're going to bed. Your day's over. And this whole other world happens. It's terrible. So these fucking assholes then put them in a car. One brother drives with the hostages. The other brother takes one of their cars with them. And they go for another drive. They go for a drive and they turn off this very desolate road. And it's, you know, Wichita, Kansas. It gets cold. It's December. It's nearly Christmas. And it's a very snowy night. It is snowing. I'm from South Texas. So to me, I'm like, it's not comfortable conditions. But it's cold. It's no doubt it's cold. It's fucking snowing. And unfortunately, they're ordered to get out of the vehicle. And they're executed. They're all shot. They take a bullet to the back of the head. And then that's it. They're just left in the snow. And what they didn't plan on is not everybody died. We have a survivor. That survivor being HG. The initials are for her protection. I know I said that her name is Holly, but I think now, like, I found that because it's been 20 years. But at the time, she did not want that. You know, they didn't want that information out because she survived. And we don't, you know, it was a fucking home invasion that just went further and further downhill, took a fucking nosedive. I wouldn't want to give out her information either until we know who they are, because who knows what they're capable of at that point. It's one thing to do a home invasion, take their shit and leave. They were there for fucking hours, taking them on joyrides to get their money. And then just, like I said, just making it worse and worse. It's not even to add insult to injury. It's adding injury to the insult with them. It's fucking gross. So what happened is when they shot HG, her barrette deflected the bullet. The bullet still hit her. She still has a head injury, but it caused it to not be lethal. And, you know, this poor girl, she comes to, sits up, looks over, and there's her friends. She tries to check on them. She takes her gun. It's cold outside, and this girl completely takes her clothes off to try to help Brad. Not Brad, I'm sorry, Jason. I'm so sorry. She tries to help Jason, realizing then that she can't do enough. They need help. She needs help. So she, like I said, it's snowing. She can hardly see. She's injured. She sees Christmas lights. And that's what she follows. That is the only thing guiding her to any kind of help. Christmas lights. This woman walks over a mile in the cold, barefoot, no fucking clothes on. She climbed a barbed wire fucking fence and crossed a highway. The will to live is remarkable. It really is. It actually made me think of Wind River. I don't know if y'all have ever seen that movie. Great fucking watch. But there's that beautiful shot of her running through the snow. Of course, it's Wyoming, which is hella fucking colder. But that's what I pictured. Just this woman with this will to live, this undying will to live, trekking such conditions. She does make it to the Christmas light and she gets help. So, and as it is, it just so happens as the people who in that house call the police for help, an officer comes across a Honda Civic in the middle of this desolate area. He pulls over, looks at it, because he doesn't know if people are okay. And again, it's cold. You don't know what's in there. And as he comes around the car, he finds four bodies. So then he calls for backup. And you know, so you got one dispatcher hearing one thing, dispatch with the officers hearing something, and they're totally connecting. So HG is in the hospital. You know, they call an ambulance. They get her to the hospital because she has a severe head injury. She does. And this woman is so fucking dedicated to finding who hurt her friends that she refuses to go into surgery before she talks to the police out of fear that she won't make it and she won't be able to share their story and let them know what happened to her friends and what was done to them. Remarkable. So she does this and she goes into surgery. She comes out fine. So after collecting her statement, they go back to the house of the roommate. And like, you couldn't like be any more annoyed and just like, ugh, with these fucking dudes. They go to the house. It looks like these motherfuckers doubled back and stole the electronics. They really robbed the shit out of that house. They took everything. But they also took Jason's truck. They took his, I want to say it's a Dodge Dakota. I had it written down, but I feel weird like getting my notes and like with the pages. I'm pretty sure it's a Dakota. Because I don't think Durango's came in pickups. I think it's a Dakota. It's a Dakota. Yeah, I'm pretty positive. So they have something other than just a description of who did this. They have a vehicle to look for. The media is in a fucking frenzy over this. They're putting, you know, be on the lookout. Newspapers running it. The news is running it. The radio is running it. Everybody is talking about this vicious attack and letting people know what kind of vehicle to be on the lookout for. Because, again, this took a really hard fucking left from just holding people up in their car. So, that next day, they get a call from someone saying that they've actually seen that truck in their apartment complex. They saw it in the parking lot. No. So, you know, great. You know, they're perfect. Finally, something. And I mean, this is hours after the attack. Not even a day. I don't know exactly what time, but it was in the morning. And as it is, when they called 911, when they called for HG, it was just before 2 in the morning. So definitely under 12 hours that this truck is spotted. Like, awesome. He calls the police and the police, well, actually, I don't even think he calls the police. From everything I saw, he like ran to a police station and tells them what he saw. And then, so an officer shows up, identifies that the vehicle is indeed Jason's. And as he's looking at it, another man comes up and tells them, I just helped a man carry a heavy TV up to the third floor. So, and like, that makes so much sense. Like, if y'all are young, y'all have no idea how fucking heavy TVs were back then. It was ridiculous. They're huge and bulky and boxy. Ugh, God. As much as I love the 90s, I'm glad I didn't have to deal with that shit. Ugh. But so, now they have a location on where these people are also. So that officer calls for backup, letting them know that he's identified where they are. And like 80 officers show up. Everybody's fucking there. Everybody wants a piece of these motherfuckers. But also, it's an apartment complex. There's so many people in there. You don't know how many people are in the apartment. You don't know what you're going to get. So, I mean, I'm not saying 80 is necessary. I'm happy it was fucking 80. But I'm glad it wasn't just 2. You know what I mean? But it's not like Wichita is like this tiny little town or anything like that either. But, so officers go up, knock on the door, and a woman responds. Well, who's this lady? She responds, and she does come to the door, but she's very evasive, you know, where they like crack the door and they're like, yes, you know, peering through there all weird, like just open the goddamn door. It's like, and you know, she's trying to kind of, you know, I don't know, that kind of shit, clearly protecting them. And one officer gets a good glimpse inside and notices there is a lot of electronics in that apartment. So, you know, and we know that the house was ransacked, and because there were so many people living in there, it does make sense that there would be more than one TV in that house. So, as they're like talking her and trying to, you know, not immediately kick in the door, but, you know, they're talking to her and everything. And since officers are surrounding this building, this dude's like, oh, I'll go on the balcony. What are you going to do on the third floor of the balcony? Really? Jump? Go for it. Let's do that. Help yourself. But this dude goes onto the balcony. And, I mean, he's spotted immediately by officers. And they start shouting, you know, put your fucking hands up, get the fuck out, blah, 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 you know, fuck you, dude. Who knows? And the officers who are at the front door talking to this woman hear it. And basically, it's fucking go time at this point. Now, for sure, he's in there. They're not going to be yelling anywhere else. Well, I guess they could be, but anyway, they start yelling. They hear the yelling, realize that it's in the same apartment, and they kick the fucking door in. And this, I mean, they arrest him pretty quickly, and they actually ended up arresting Jonathan. That was his girlfriend. And yeah, he had been hiding out at her place. But Reginald is nowhere to be found still. They don't know where he is. So they take Reginald in, and apparently his only words were, I need a lawyer. Like, God damn it, I'm going to need a fucking lawyer. Like, yeah, bitch, you're most definitely going to need a lawyer. So now that they have him, you know, again, media frenzy, they have a face to put to the crime, at least one. They have a face to put to the crime. Shit's everywhere. His name's going everywhere. And, you know, just also in town is a girl. She's there on a date. You remember those dates where like your boyfriend would come over, or a guy you like would come over, and y'all would sit in the room and watch, like, the living room, and watch TV with the parents and everything as a way to spend time together, like to court each other, but under supervision. Well, that's what this girl's doing. She met a guy at a mall a few weeks ago. They've been talking, and they're hanging out at her house watching the news together. Well, it just so happened Jonathan's face pops up, boop, about him at the crime. And the girl looks at her guy and is just like, isn't that your brother? That is your brother. He was with you when we met, you know? Which kind of makes me laugh, because she's saying it like, yeah, you know, like, that's not weird reaction to the fact that the horrible crime, like, his brother's there. I don't know. Well, so they're like, she's like, yeah, your brother. Well, she says this in front of her mother, and her mother's like, red fucking flag, get this bitch out of my house. So she goes, and first thing she does is she actually checks Reginald's pockets, because she wants to make sure this dude didn't bring a gun in her house. Like, she doesn't know he's gonna fucking rob him too. She doesn't know. Good move. But what she does find is the engagement ring that Jason had bought. And because this was mentioned on the news too, at this point, she knew without a doubt, this man is also involved. He's the other man they're looking for. She excuses herself, and another smart move, she calls the police from her neighbor's apartment. That way she's not suspicious and whispering, or, you know, going to the garage to call, all that weird shit. No, she goes to her neighbor's house and makes the phone call. And police start coming, and Reginald tries to run. He does make a run for it, but apparently the officer that catches him can fucking run. He takes him down, and Reginald's arrested as well. You know, so now they're both captured. They're not talking. They just want an attorney. But they are identified by Ann Walenta as the man who attacked her. And unfortunately, before they could go to court, I want to say like within a few days after she identified them, Ann passed away. She had a pulmonary embolism that was a direct, indirect relation to her wounds from being shot. That would have never happened if they wouldn't have shot her. So they are liable for that death as well. It's considered another murder. So they go to trial, and as it is, these boys are fucking foul. Foul. They're no remorse, making faces, taunting the jury and the family members. I think at one point one of them blows a kiss. Just really shitty behavior. Just like, on and honestly kind of hopeless at that point. At that point, you're kind of just like, whoa, like these dudes are never gonna fucking get it. Like, it's hopeless. To where I believe, I can't remember which one of them at some point ends up getting removed from the court proceedings because his behavior is just over the top and too much, and the judge just makes it to where he can't be in there. So these family members had to hear, like, Andrew testified. Poor Ann wasn't able to because she passed away. But the most powerful and most important testimony was HG's. HG took the stand. And this girl pulled at everybody's heartstrings because of what she lived through. She witnessed her friends die. She was left for dead in the fucking snow. Lame. And all she did is go to bed. That's all she did that night. She wasn't anybody's face. She wasn't out in some shady part of town. She wasn't, even if she wasn't, like, she just, you know, she was at home. So her testimony, you know, is just heartbreaking. This, the family of her roommates have to hear firsthand what they encountered, what she witnessed them do to her friends, what she saw. It's one thing when the police say, like, you know, evidence shows this, and they show pictures. Not only are you seeing pictures, she's telling you word for word what she witnessed, what she heard, what she was thinking. And like, the most powerful thing that I love that she said was that she had a choice to lay there and die or to get up and live, and she chose to live. The will to live. It's beautiful. I have no doubt that she had that room in tears, because like, I'm kind of like, my eyes feel all moist and shit just talking about that, because it's beautiful. And you hope that should you be in that same circumstance, I know I think about this a lot because I'm way into true, I'm like too far into true crime. I think about that constantly. I constantly hope that I have that in me. That's what's in me. I recently learned that I might not, because I actually was in a road rage incident on Thanksgiving. I left my purse at my grandmother's and I went to my parents' house to pick it up. These guys were driving without headlights on. It's 9 o'clock at night. It's fucking dark. So when I pulled out, I didn't see them. They turned their headlights as they almost hit me. I like waved them off. I was so sorry. I was scared. I drive off and I see them make a U-turn and follow me. It's Thanksgiving. The roads are dead. I pass a Catholic church. They cut me off. And every time I try to go around him, he picks up speed. The other one gets out of the car and approaches my window. And I froze. I was terrified. And all I kept thinking of was, I was in my boyfriend's car, because my car keys were in my purse. I was in my boyfriend's car, and I can't wreck his car. Like, that would be important to him, right? Like, that's all, like, just the politeness in me and the courtesy was still in me, where all I could think of was, if I run this guy over and hit his car, he's going to be mad that I wrecked, like, not even that he's going to be mad, I wrecked his car, you know? It's just going to be, I wrecked his car. So I called the police, and I just started talking and giving the number. Of course, it was a fucking paper plate. I just started telling her the number. And the other guy started coming to my window, and then the friend, like, tiptoed. And because I was in an SUV, he couldn't see my lap. The guy tiptoed, looked what was in my lap, and I raised the volume on the car so he could hear the dispatcher. And I started repeating the license plate, the model of the car, the year. I'm not too fucking bad with cars, dudes. All right? So don't fucking try me, because I can more than likely guess your fucking year and your model and your make. All right? I may not be able to tell them the cylinders, but I might actually. But I can most definitely tell you the year. All right? I'm not that clueless. Because they saw that, they got in their car and took off. So, after that, now, you know, it sucks because I want to be like HG. I don't want to freeze. I don't want to just lie there. So hearing that, like, kind of made me well up and everything, because, like, it made me realize that I need to build that strength to become like HG. I think we all strive to be it. And now that I've learned that that's not as in me as I thought, that I need a lot of self-growth and I need confidence and I need to really build myself up. So should I be in something like that again, I can fucking fight. Because I froze. It was terrifying. But HG told her harrowing story, this beautiful survival story. It's not beautiful, but it's some of her wording was eloquent to where it really captivates how she felt, what she was going through, and you like bleed with her. She's a remarkable woman just for that. These two men are found, so what I'm looking for, they are found guilty, they're sentenced to death. Good fucking riddance. I know people are gonna be like, oh, the death penalty. I'm sorry, but I'd rather them get death than some bullshit sentence of, I don't know, take a plea bargain and they only do 20 years or something like that. Because, I mean, we've seen things like that happen with violent crime. So, I'd rather take death. Sentence to death, and at one point, they appeal their case, saying that they should have been tried separately. Like, yeah, because one of y'all did worse than the other, right? Doubtful. So, the Supreme Court actually does overturn their death sentences. But, like, a year, 2 years later, they're reinstated. Like, nope. Even individually, y'all done fucked up. Y'all did some horrible shit. Like, no. When, you know, why would they take mercy on you? You took mercy on no one. So, they are still sentenced to death. They're still in prison. But, this story has some sweet with the bitter. We have a light at the end of the tunnel. During the court proceedings, you know, Andrew Schreiber also testified, so him and HG connect. And they're really the only people who knows what the other endured to a certain extent. Andrew didn't endure as much as HG, but he still felt the terror. And it's from the same people. So they build a bond. And they fall in love. To where they go on, get married. They have children. Andrew actually takes a change in his career path and becomes an officer to serve and protect. And I hope they live happily ever after. Don't leave. Anybody who endures such heinous actions, I wish the best for all of you. I was thrilled to hear that, which is why I wanted to cover this story, because it's so ugly and it's so fucking dark. But they found light, and we can find light too. So I hope if y'all, I like my channel's like nothing, but if somehow this ever gets back to y'all, I'm just super happy. But yeah, so that is the traumatic story of the horror of the Carr brothers. Again, would they have been this way if their mother, their parents, even if one parent gave a shit, would they still be this way? Or maybe one would be a bad egg and the other would choose a different life. There wouldn't be that dependency. We'll never know. But, you know, again, I'm just grateful that this story had a glimmer of like, God damn it, I just want to change the color of this. So, I hope you enjoyed this. I know my storytelling isn't top tier, but I'm getting there. All right, patience. This is only episode 6. And I'm not even a fucking procrastinator. You know, time. I need a 13th hour. But I thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, share. But thank you for being here with me. And I hope y'all have a great night. It's Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to y'all. And yeah, I'll catch you on the next one. Bye.